want to welcome you to Amaravati this afternoon. The subject is silence, so that people keep thinking that I'm going to probably not say anything. But these Sunday afternoon talks are for reflection, and silence is only realized through reflecting, using our capacities to listen, to be awake and alert. Otherwise, we're caught up into the noisiness of life is our own thinking. When we are obsessed with our own views, our own ideas and thoughts, then even in the midst of a very tranquil and serene environment, we can still be very, very noisy, as probably many of you are aware. Monasteries themselves, people, when they come to monasteries from a busy, active life, say in a city like London, and then they feel the quiet and the silence of the environment. Then after a while they get used to that silence, but their minds start going on and on and on, and they're conflicting, doubting, uncertain, confused patterns. Therefore, even in the midst of a community that meditates, and in the environment that's fairly quiet, we can create noise. One thing I found out in the monastic life is that the noise that we create, we can actually learn to not do that through mindfulness, through understanding things in the right way. We can actually stop creating noise in our minds around the environment or the situations we find ourselves in. In a society that is increasingly noisy, and that we find now it more and more difficult to get away from the noise of, say, our modern technology. Just in the beech grove across the road, the 8 acre of beech forest that belonged to this monastery, it itself is quite lovely to be in, but the noise of traffic from the Leighton Buzzard Road rises up, and you hear this almost continuous noise of the sound of passing vehicles and lorries. In a country like Thailand, where I lived many years, then say one would seek idyllic spots where there would be the least amount of irksome and unwanted noises, only to find the transistor radio, where the farmers would be plowing their fields with the water buffalo, the transistor radio connected to its horns. So these are they say in a society that keeps trying to invent new things. We also create more problems in many other ways. This nature itself, though, is not really very silent. If you listen to a forest, say a tropical forest at night, or even in the day, there is always a high level of insect sounds, or wind rustling the leaves, or whatever, just the sounds that animals make. then we reflect on the very obvious fact that we're living in a sensual world. Our very form is a noisy one. Our, let's say, the just ability to speak, to think, to be able to create sounds with our voices, to be able to create conflict within our minds, with our thoughts and ideas, emotions. That the birth of a human being immediately implies that this is our fate, the realm of sensory impingement, of a continuous, ongoing onslaught of irritating conditions affecting this particular form. So when we want the world and the universe to not be the way it is, and not want our bodies or this sensory experience, when we don't want it to be the way it has to be, then we create suffering, anguish, despair, grief, sorrow. The whole range of negative emotional states is created around that desire to get something or to make something or to get rid of something. Now the reflective mind is one in which we can understand the situation we're in. And this is what the teaching of the Buddha, its purpose and its value is that it points and helps us to contemplate this strange experience of birth, consciousness, feeling and sensitivity, intelligence. I mean, there's a lot of many very very lovely qualities we experience too. Not just not putting it down as an irritating experience from birth to death. But what I'm trying to point to is the fact that being born means that we are going to experience this continuous impingement from the objects of our senses. And that's just the way it is. There's nothing ultimately right, wrong, or ultimately good or bad about it. It's just the way it is. It can be pleasant, it can be unpleasant, it can be at times pleasant and at times unpleasant. It can change very rapidly from pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant. And so that our life from birth to death is to be understood, is to be a life of awakened awareness, mindfulness, wisdom, intelligence, understanding of this experience we all share, of being conscious beings and feeling both the pleasure, the pain, the beauty and the ugliness of this sensory realm. The complaining mind, the mind in which we feel that somehow life should be otherwise. We can imagine, can't we? We can imagine a universe, a world, where everything is just the way we want it to be. I remember as a child feeling that I could have done a much better job than God did. If I were left to create the universe, I wouldn't have created any pain in it, for one thing. And everything would have been much more pleasant and harmonious according to a child's mind. Wouldn't it be nice if everything were just all you had to eat was what you liked, and you didn't have to eat anything you didn't like. And the weather was always warm and pleasant. People were always friendly and kind. And nobody ever got angry or cross or grumpy. And the lion could lie down with the lamb. and there could be an eternal spring of pleasure, sunshine, or a kind of permanent sweets shop. A life just of pleasurable sensations and beauty, and nothing unpleasant. And I think that's what makes children wonder, why should life be, why should one experience pain, or fear, or anger, or many people are brought up or have to experience all kinds of conflicting, unwanted things in their lives from just their family experience or the particular events that happen around them. Or some children are born with all kinds of defects already, on painful physical problems or inadequate kind of health problems. So if I were king of the world, and if I were God, and if I could create something that would be what I would want, there wouldn't be any mosquitoes. There wouldn't be any midges. England would have the perfect climate. It would be a very different world than the one that we experience in daily life from birth to death. But in the long run, it's probably a very good thing that I'm not God. Because I don't think that the world I would have created as a child would be a world that I particularly want to live in right now. Childish things get rather dreary, don't they? And the candy shop and the sweets and the toys and all the ideas of happiness and delight, we outgrow. We no longer think that having everything we want, everything that pleases us, is going to really give us the security and happiness that we aspire or yearn or long for. Because humanity is also a spiritual creation. We're meant for something much finer, much more profound, deeper, true wisdom, true enlightenment, not just for a pleasant, sensual experience as a human being. Silence, then, when we meditate on silence, is a meditation of listening, to where we begin to know the difference between just the natural way of things, the experience of life in this sensual form. We can see the difference, we can realize the natural way of things, what we call the true Dhamma. And then we can also be aware of what we create out of our greed, hatred, delusion, out of our desires and fears. Now, to spend one's life trying to get rid of the mosquitoes, the midges, the airplanes, trying to control everyone, trying to find the perfect Shangri-La, the place where I will not be disrupted or disturbed. If I spent my life just seeking the ideal situation for myself, where there's the least possible amount of sensory irritation, frustration, annoyance. And say if I did find such a place, I did find a really super quiet place where nothing in the place itself was irritating or unwanted. If I did happen to find such a place, I would consider that now a very unfortunate situation. Because it would never give me the chance to grow up. If I could get what I wanted out of life from my desires, I would never have the opportunity to grow up. I would never develop as a spiritual being. I might develop it as a strong attachment to refined states of consciousness, or tranquility, or serenity, a mental serenity, but not the profound and deep and real understanding of the nature of things. Because my serenity and my tranquility very much depend upon things being a certain way. And I've seen this in my own experience of life as a Buddhist monk. When you get very dependent upon things being a certain way, and when that is disrupted, you feel very annoyed, very angry, very frustrated by that. Now, in Buddhist monasticism, one tends to get dependent upon, say, refinements. You're moving more toward a refined mental plane as a Buddhist monk. You're just the refraining and relinquishment of exciting sensory impingement. It's like we can't see sensory stimulation in any to avoid or not seek out music or exciting games, sports, all kinds of things that excite and stimulate our senses. Buddhist monks are we can't seek that out. Just celibacy itself, the living a celibate, chaste life means that we no longer can seek or incline toward sexual excitements. Toward violent actions means that we can't, men especially, I think, find physical violence very exciting. And we can't hit each other, have boxing matches, dueling or anything like that. We have to remain quite restrained. And myself, who never thought of myself as a particularly physically violent man, have noticed that at certain moments of my monastic life, very strong tendencies towards physical violence that I've fortunately restrained. But violence is an exciting vibration, isn't it? Sex is exciting. And as we get beyond just sex and violence towards more refined levels of sensory, of sound and sight, and then thought itself can be very clever, very refined into a spaciousness of mind that's very dependent upon non-stimulation or no stimulation. Silence, then, I would say, the silence that one seeks in Buddhist meditation, or that one finds in meditation, doesn't mean that there isn't any sound or there's no irritation. It's not a silence that depends upon things being any certain way at all. But it is a stillness or a silence that one realizes when one is very observant. The true nature, the underlying unity, which is silent and pure, bright and intelligent, not conflicting, not stimulating, not exciting. But it's not a thing either. It's not something. And it's not a person. It's not, one can't say that it's the body, it's in one's brain or in one's, or it's in one's heart. But through a determined effort to understand Dhamma, or the true nature of things, then more and more one abides in a stillness of mind, a continuity in stillness and silence that isn't dependent, if whatever happens to be going on around one is not a disruption. And because of this, then one can be quite at ease, even in the midst of very disrupting, very unpleasant, very horrible sensory impingement. As well as one can also be completely silent and peaceful, even with the most alluring and tantalizing refinements that happen to be passing by through the eyes, the ears, or the sense organs, or the mind itself. Now I would call this true peacefulness also. It's a peace that isn't, that when we talk about peace in this present age, it's usually meaning something external, something outside, the stopping the battles, the wars, all the conflicts that humans create externally. And so peacefulness is it, but that kind of peace must really generate from that sense of stillness and silence within. Because just say demanding that you not fight, that me sitting here laying down the law to you, thou shalt not fight, thou shalt not irritate each other or make any noises, unwanted noises, or be aggressive in any way, this might, we might all agree that this would be very nice, but under certain conditions we find very strong reactions that even surprise, even in our most say idealistic states of mind, where we think we would like a world where there's no cruelty, no violence, no physical violence, no irritating, conflicting things happening to us or to anyone. Yet, in spite of all that, that strong, say, altruistic aspiration for peace, we find very much the very strong reactions in daily life that are anything but peaceful or altruistic. And that when you really look at the way, not taking it personally or judging these things on the personal plane as ultimately good or bad, but we begin to notice that these forms, these sensory forms, are the way they are. That violence, a sexual desire, just the need to survive, instinctual desires, instinctual habits and inclinations are the way they are. If one attaches to them, if one identifies with them, then you feel very much that you are that kind of a person. And this is very much the suffering of the present age, modern humanity. They, in a country like this, we identify very strongly with the feelings, the conflicts that go through our minds. We take them very, very personally. Everything is judged and labeled, analyzed from the attitude of, it's my problem, what's wrong with me, I am this way. Rather than from the position of the Buddha, which sees the way things are, this is the way it is, that these forms, these the sensory consciousness itself, the ability to feel and to experience life within the human form, it's this way. If we take it personally, then we suffer. Because so much of our life isn't what we want it to be. We can't always think or feel the way we would like to feel or think from an ideal of what we would create and how life would be if I was God and I had created everything. We are the results of the whole creative universal creation. This is the result here and now. It's like this. This human form here, sitting here, is this way. Now if I spent the afternoon complaining because I don't want to be, I don't want to look like this, I don't want to have these, you know, one can always think of how much better it would be if things were better. And how, you know, somehow, because maybe I didn't get quite the best equipment when I was born, anyway, what I imagine, if I were God creating the world, I would have looked very different than the way I did. And but this is the way it is. This say reflection on the way it is means that the mind itself is an embracing mind, or all-encompassing. This sense of the mind embracing everything rather than the mind being just a kind of flash through the brain or a feeling in the heart. Contemplate this yourself in most of you who have been born and brought up in a Western society or in an Eastern society which has been very much influenced, very much infected with the Western attitudes. Now the modern Western attitude is very much based on a strong feeling of being a person. We always are concerned with ourselves first, my individual rights, my independence, myself. And it's a very humanistic approach. It's very idealistic. I am an individual and I have my rights. And that this is my life. And that this life is not connected to anything above either. It's modern, even though one might have been had influences from, say, religion like Judaism or Christianity, the general attitude, the general run of conditioning that most of us experience, I'm speaking from being an American anyway, that the general attitude wasn't one of a real sustained relationship to anything higher than, say, one's own being, one's own existence as a personality, and the relationships one was going to form with other human beings in one's lifetime. Very much an education to learn how to get the approval of other people, how to obey, to be an obedient, acceptable, normal type of human being, how to fulfill one's role in life, the expectations that the society has for you as a man or a woman. And humanism, modern humanism, and modern science do not relate, say, a human being's life experience with the divine or with a transcendent reality. Very much, say, in the past, before, say, empirical science became the dominant kind of acceptable world outlook, the old, say, Middle Ages of Christianity, or any religion in its pure and the times when it was at its peak and of purity and effectiveness, was always relating one's individual being and experience of life with a transcendent reality, with God or with an ultimate law or with divinity of, or deity, something beyond just the sensory consciousness that we have and the planetary life that we're involved with from birth to death. That this life, planetary life, is very brief, really. When you get my age, you look, I was on a walk for the past week on the South Downs, and I kept thinking, this thought kept occurring to me, how, say, when I think ahead to 20, 30 years, it seems like a long time. But when I look back 20, 30 years, it seems like just a very brief time. Do any of you find any truth in that? Looking back 30 years. And yet, still, I look ahead 30 years, it seems like I've got a lot of time yet. I think 30 years left. It's a long time. So that what we, so time itself is very much a creation of our mind. That time we think is a kind of constant reality, and yet time is very much an illusion of the mind. What determines time really is how happy or how unhappy. The emotional time, happiness is goes by very quickly, and unhappiness seems to linger forever. If you want to spend an eternity in hell, that's 5 minutes of misery. Can be seem like an eternity. For 5 hours of blissful happiness is like 5 minutes, just zooms by. So when we contemplate this, we have this ability to reflect on say just the way things are. Why is it that happiness always seems to go by very quickly? And why pain and misery seem to just take forever? It seems to go on and it never end, even though it might in actual terms or length of time, solar time, it might not be that long. So then we contemplate that we want happiness and we don't want suffering. So the desire itself, when we're attached to desire, then that desire is the illusion we have. The delusion of the mind, that desire deludes us into the perceptions of eternal hell, but wanting eternal happiness. Dreading the fact that we might have eternal hell and not have any more happiness. So when we find happiness, we try to hold on to it, which means that when you hold on to something, the happiness that you initially experienced vanishes. Because grasping itself is no longer a happy state of mind. You can't really be happy and grasping and trying to hold on to things, because that very mental state of grasping and holding on is a miserable state of mind. If you really look at it, if you really examine that what you're actually feeling when you're trying to hold on to somebody or something or some idea, you'll begin to realize that it is a kind of misery, an anguish. Where happiness, usually we experience happiness when we're not grasping. When we let go and suddenly just are with or enjoying something truly beautiful or truthful or delightful, either on the sense plane or the mental plane, or the silence. What is ultimate happiness for the human, for human experience, is not sensory beauty or sensory delight, but the knowledge of the silence and the realization of stillness and silence. And that kind of happiness, you can say, is through non-grasping. And the Buddhist the term for that Buddhists use for that is nibbana or nirvana. Nirvana is the Sanskritized version of nibbana, which I've heard many translations. It's a very kind of enigmatic word. Some people just assume it's a kind of heavenly state where you're just kind of in a state of blissful laughing and singing. And everything is like the world I would have created at 4 years old, nibbana. Or you read about people's interpretations of nibbana as a kind of extinction, annihilation. Some people regard nibbana as annihilation, where there's absolutely nothing. There's no sensitivity, no intelligence, no brightness. It's just a blank void, a vacuum of nothingness. But if you study the scriptures and practice the meditations that the Buddha advised, then more and more you realize nibbana is the non-grasping. So that in one reference the Buddha called nibbana the highest happiness. And then this makes us contemplate, what did he mean by happiness then? Because happiness, I used to think of happiness as getting what I wanted. Because there's a certain kind of happiness you feel when you get what you want. Or happiness is maybe where everything is the idealized form of, where everything is pretty and comfortable and pleasant and harmonious and everything's nice. There's no disruption, no noticeable irritations. No disruptions going on in your life, and that might be nibbana. But the Buddha definitely made his point that nibbana is here and now, not dependent upon things being any certain way. Doesn't depend on whether there's a plane flying overhead, or this room is on fire, or everybody's happy or unhappy, or whether everything's harmonious, or it's cold or hot, or there are midges, mosquitoes, poisonous snakes, wild animals, terrorists and insurgents creeping around. Or it's just an average Sunday afternoon like this, I'm reminded. But nibbana then is a realization of non-grasping. To realize it doesn't just happen. Say, through Buddhist meditation, you're not just an accident of fate, just one of those moments that suddenly realize or experience nibbana. But it's a cultivation and a real inclination, movement toward the silence and stillness of being. And reflection and understanding. Nibbana isn't a kind of dumb silence where you just don't know anything because there's nothing around to stimulate anything in your mind. But the realization of nibbana then is where the mind is free from grasping and the individual being, human being, realizes non-grasping. And the freedom of the human heart and the relief that one feels, the relief that one feels from non-grasping. Now, is happiness, say, when you're really happy, what do you have to make you really happy? Contemplate this, to be really happy. In modern materialist societies, happiness is very much what people are seeking. If you, all the advertisements, the advertising is endless allurements. And you will be happier if you have this, if you have that. It is the idea of getting things, of having things. And yet, the highest happiness is the happiness of non-attachment. That is not dependent on having anything or not having anything. It doesn't mean we have to get rid of everything to not be attached. It means we have to realize, we can realize non-attachment. It's not an idealization of non-attachment. You shouldn't be, the idealization would be, you shouldn't be attached to anything. And then that's still reinforcing the idea that you are somebody who has all these attachments to everything and you shouldn't have them. And try to detach yourself from everything and from yourself with the idea that you are somebody who is attached. Just try to do it. See where it gets you. You go around and around. If you start out from the attitude, the view that you are somebody, already you've got it wrong. Then if you attach to the opposite one, that you're nobody, that's not right either. Because then you're somebody who's nobody. But with the reflectiveness of mind, the directness of the Buddha's teaching is to reflect on that whole process, to see it as an object rather than as a position one takes or an assumption one makes. So I am somebody or I am nobody is a condition or process of the mind, but not, if you grasp it, then you're always going to interpret your experience of life from being somebody or being somebody who's nobody. But when there is just the immediate awareness of the true nature of thought as impermanent and not self, then that is a moment of awareness, true awareness. And the more you realize that, then the more you will realize the highest happiness. Which isn't happiness like a child of getting what you want, or getting the best, or winning the competition, being the best in the world, or the biggest, or the prettiest, or whatever, but in just the true beauty, ultimate beauty and goodness of being in mindfulness and in wisdom, within the limitations we find ourselves, within the limitations of these human forms, whatever state they might be in, aging or sick or young or male or female or rich or poor, whatever. This isn't the highest happiness. There's no highest happiness in being rich or poor, male or female, young or old, sick or healthy. That's not the highest happiness. The highest happiness is the realization of non-grasping any of that, whatever it might be. Then the cultivation, the way of a Buddhist, then is to allow that realization to enter your life as much as possible. And to do that is to be very vigilant and determined and resolved to see that in everything, in every way, in every experience. Walking on the Downs this past week, we started off on Monday walking from Chithurst, and I had people had been very generous in giving me the very best camping equipment. Over the past 2 years, I've not done this. I've not gone on these walks. So over the past 2 years, I've accumulated some of the finest camping equipment that's available in the Western world. I thought I should take this camping equipment that's been done. So I had this very heavy pack of the very best camping equipment. And as you walk out of Chithurst, you can walk to the South Downs, walk to Harting, the little village of Harting, and up Harting Hill is just like that, with a very heavy pack. And by the time, and that's where we were to meet the person who was going to offer the food. So it was we had to get there at a certain time. The time I reached the top of Harting Hill, I was totally exhausted. And then everything happened quite nicely, and we had to walk to another place that night to camp, and then walk to another place in the morning to meet a person for another meal. So by the time I arrived the next day at the place where we were going to eat, I was physically very exhausted. But reflecting on it, just contemplating this situation, just noticing things like when your body doesn't want to move, and yet you can make it do so, just mentally will it to go. Because that's what I had to do the second day. I had to will it and force it, because the body, if I just left it up to itself, wouldn't. These rather negative mental states arising. The resultant karma of having been a grumbler and complainer in my life. These kind of inadequate mental state, grumbling, blaming, this going off into blaming people or grumbling. But there was determination to not follow or believe any of that, but to just witness this, not to annihilate those states, but to not believe them either, to just know them for what they are. So that whole tendency fell away, to just feel negative about it. Then actually after a while you got in a kind of rhythm where you could just keep going and plodding on to get to the place you were to meet this lady. Well, things like this are using this ability to watch and to reflect on the way it is. To be able to understand, to contemplate, to see that these mental states were not to something to follow or to suppress. If I were an idealistic monk, thinking a good monk shouldn't complain, should always be grateful. All the people have given me this, the best camping equipment. I should be very grateful for this. I shouldn't be complaining. I should only have thoughts of loving kindness for all those wonderful people who gave me all this heavy equipment. So that's the idealistic one. Or if the mind would tend to think, I'm getting too old for this, I'm not young, I don't have the I'm not resilient anymore, youth is past, I shouldn't be, blah, 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 blah. This you're listening to, you're observing it as an object, but not as a position to take on any issue or on life itself. You're aware, but not grasping. So I would say, even though there is physical fatigue, and I was willing myself to go on out of necessity, there wasn't any real suffering. There was a lot of physical discomfort, but I wouldn't call any of that suffering. I call suffering would be the grasping of the pain, the grasping of the mental states, the either grasping through indulging and believing in them, or carrying on in that way, or the grasping of annihilation, of rejection, of denial, of suppression. But when one kept opening the mind to reflect on the way it is, then one felt quite all right with the way it was then. It wasn't, I would not say I suffered. Then, because I was tired, I had the opportunity, since I was the senior monk, to determine where we were going. And so for the next 2 days, we didn't go anywhere. And by that time, the body was ready to go. So suddenly I felt this, my body just wanted to put on that pack and get going. And so we walked and had a very lovely walk after that across the downs and we ended up in Lansing near Hove. Now this is just, say, using meditation and reflection as, say, while on a walk where you're having to say experience maybe physical discomfort. Some of the nights were quite chilly and mornings quite dewy, so that one had to kind of learn to accept a lack of coziness and warmth and a measure of dampness that one, say, doesn't usually put up with in ordinary life. But yet that's not suffering either. It's only suffering when you don't want it to be that way. When you wish you weren't there. When you don't want the dew in the morning or the chill of the evening. Then that's suffering. But actually, the chill in the evening is bearable. It's quite all right. And the dew in the morning is quite all right. The wetness and the dampness, the discomfort, the sore feet, and all that are all bearable, all endurable. And not suffering. The abiding in the silence of the mind allows one to have this perspective. As you identify and know the true silence and stillness, the very center of being in mindfulness, awareness in this moment, then there is no suffering. And this the Buddha made very clear, and that I teach suffering and the end of suffering. Suffering and the end of suffering. The end of suffering is always the non-attachment to the damp, the dew, the chill, the sore feet, the feeling of physical fatigue, to the airplane flying overhead, to the annoying, irritating person, to the frustrations of the sensory experience. None of this we would call suffering. It only becomes suffering when you react to it with desire to get rid of it, desire to hold on to it, desire to get something, to keep something, desire to get rid of something, then we create a realm of suffering in which we're no longer abiding in the true silence and awareness of being, but we are caught in a realm of habit and reaction that can only bring us to despair and anguish, sorrow and grief. But when we are mindful, or truly aware, then in spite of all the unwanted physical, sensual, mental impingement and experiences that any human being is quite capable of having in a lifetime, when there's non-attachment, when there's knowledge and understanding of the Dhamma or the true way of things, then we say there is no suffering. Now, I think this is very important for you to contemplate and not think of no suffering as not feeling anything anymore, or feeling only happy and the pleasant and the pleasurable sensations, but no suffering is a profound realization in the midst of, and can be, and there can be no suffering in the midst of pain and war, confusion, cold and damp and fatigue and irritation and frustration on this external world of sensory, of the sense objects. In my life is before I became a monk, I had a very kind of profound experience at the age of 19, where my mind suddenly stopped thinking, and there was this beautiful silence. The mind, when you're 19, I think it's a very difficult age. Was for me, because you're not really adult yet, but you're supposed to be, and your self-consciousness is very powerful. You're very aware of yourself in a society. You're always worried and concerned what others think of you, and it reaches a very strong peak at the age of 19. And so I was in this state of despair and misery over myself at the age of 19, and suddenly it stopped just one day for a few minutes. Or I don't know how long it was, but it was a timeless experience. Timeless. There was no self. And all this person, this young man that was worried about this and feeling inadequate and concerned about what other people were thinking and worried about the future and felt incapable and all these different negative states and the whole kind of self-view, habits of thinking about oneself vanished for a little while. It was bliss. So I didn't know what had happened, because I was not on drugs or anything. So I thought, oh, I'd like to be like that. Wish life could be like this all the time. I was in the military, so that night I had to go back to the naval base. All the old stuff started coming back again. All the self-consciousness, the bitterness, the fears, the anxieties, the self-consciousness all kind of flooded in, and there you were. And I thought, how is it possible to live like that experience? How could you get there? And about 2 years after that, I came across Buddhism. And I thought, that's it. That's how to do it. So when I was about 21, I read a book on Zen Buddhism, and something in me knew that if you did what they said, I probably could could find or be that way. So that this say, the life, say, of living this life of kind of dedication to Buddhism was very much a determination to cultivate that particular way of being in which there is no suffering. The lovely side of our life, say as meditators, as monks, nuns, is in its is just that as you cultivate the way more and more, you begin to, even though say Buddhism is a kind of Spartan teaching in a way, it sometimes it's austere and almost doesn't seem like very much at all. Then that, especially on the Theravada or the particular way we teach it, it can seem like pretty dreary fare, no spices in it whatsoever. But actually, it's just pointing to a very simple but very profound realization of the true nature of things. And if you're willing to pursue that and follow that to a full realization, then the rest falls into place. The beauty, the truth, the goodness, the universal benevolence, deathlessness, all these kind of perceptions and ideals and ideas and doctrines are realizable through that true inner silence of the mind, of the human mind. So I offer this for your reflection and contemplation for this afternoon, and we can have a short break, as usual, and then at about 10 minutes we can invite you all back for any questions or discussions.